Emperor Tales of the Frozen South by CWB and read by Ghost of Nuggets Past. Chapter 6. Moana Hoka. Ocean Soaring. Summary. Sherlock doesn't tell John that he simply must have some way to pass the time when they are not together, or that he has been systematically creating an ice palace in his mind to store the information he's gathering. Sometimes he fears that John, who is so much a part of the Earth, will not understand him, who is so much a part of the stars. Sherlock has cataloged several of the Elder's stories at this point. Some of them are true, having happened recently enough to be verified, but some are likely to be tall tales, legends that could not possibly have happened. Late October. John is gathering stones at the edge of the shore, and Sherlock is pretending not to stare. He could help gather stones, but that would interfere with his ability to really properly stare at John. He is simultaneously watching for leopard seals, because he told John that he couldn't help him because someone had to watch for the enemy. But he knows that no seals have been reported in this area since before the hatching season. John is beginning to molt, and Sherlock isn't sure what to think about this. His lovely silver down is not as full, and there are several bare patches where real feathers have appeared. He's taller, leaner, and the gray fuzz of his hatchling days is now highlighted by a crisp white belly. His lower mandible is marked on each side with a thick lilac stripe. This may be the most captivating element of John's impending fledge. It's not unusual for an emperor's lower mandible stripes to turn orange, or even pink, but this light lavender color is rare, and Sherlock is fascinated by it. He devises ways to get John to look in his direction so he can see it again.
Oh, is that a... No, never mind. Hey, look at the striations on this rock. Do I have something on my bill?
John's responses are nothing more than quick glances and huffs, so Sherlock turns sulky and tries to investigate his own body for signs of maturity. He has yet to start his molt, which means there isn't much to see. He supposes he should accept his fate as the only emperor in history to never develop beyond that of a stupid chick. He will be forever puffy. Cute. As if reading his mind, John glances over and says,
"Don't worry, you'll start any day now. Lots of us haven't started yet."
Sherlock sighs and looks up to the bright blue of the skies above them. A flock of terns is passing overhead, twisting and turning in sharp, precise formation, and he calls it out to John. John spares a breath from his rocks to watch them pass, and Sherlock stares at his lilac underbill markings again. Gorgeous! When the terns are no longer visible, John steps over to Sherlock and says, "Hey, Schling." Sherlock pretends to stare out at the sea. Next thing he knows, he's belly to belly with a highly amused-looking John. "Here, get a good look." Spring melts into summer. The sun is dominant in the sky now, allowing almost no darkness. Night is marked by a brief showing of twilight and dusk, and dawn is ever-present. The ice at water's edge breaks and melts, and the newly created floes drift out to sea and disappear. The colony is invigorated under the clear and brilliant sky. The adults renew their efforts toward hunting and plan for life on the open seas, while the chicks turn themselves into juveniles. There is more opportunity for exploration now and a later curfew. The chicks spend hours propelling themselves belly side down all over the island, play racing and imitating the adults in their more acrobatic maneuvers. John calls for Sherlock first thing each new day. Sherlock knows that he could call for John too, but that would rob him of the chance to hear his name trilling through the air, that perfect song finding him over and over. He tries to look disinterested as they waddle into sight of each other, but suspects the involuntary puff of his chest and jut of his head gives him away, just as it does John.
The island holds untold delights for them now, as the extended daylight and melting ice reveals new places to discover and investigate. Ice caves reveal ancient fossils and shelves upon which to climb. A fresh dusting of windswept snow gives them traction up and down small hills. And best of all, there are all sorts of previously inaccessible, lofty vantage points for them to spy from. They approach their favorite now, winding their way over craggy terrain until they arrive at a set of natural shallow steps in the ice. They have to hop and slide to make progress, but at the top they have an uninterrupted view of the plain at the center of the island, where most of the colony dwells. They lie low, not wanting to be spotted. Even if they were, they know they aren't doing anything wrong. Mostly they want to keep this secret spot for themselves. John scans the clusters of penguins below them, looking for something interesting or unusual.
"Look in the center. It's Cetus. I wonder what he's looking for."
"Based on his proclivity for healing, I'd say he's looking for something he requires for a poultice or a bomb."
"We live on a hunk of ice, Sherl Peng. What can he possibly find here?"
Sherlock leans forward and pulls a bit of loose fluff off of John's head.
"You'd be surprised, actually. Even this, a bit of your down, may be used to Cetus. There isn't much here on our hunk of ice, as you call it, but on the continent there is lichen during the warm season and algae on the tidal pools. On the far side, on the peninsula, there's grass and moss as well. Those are sometimes carried here on the winds and are bound to be rich in medicinal properties."
John looks at him now as if there's a walrus tusk growing out of the top of his head.
"Seriously, how do you know all that? More observations?"
"Not this time. I've asked Cetus about his healing practices, John. Our elders are our only source of unobservable data. If we don't absorb what they know, death will rob us of it when he comes for them."
"Do you believe all that stuff, then? About death in his ice boat and ores made of Mount Erebus's lava?"
"Lava ores seem highly improbable to me. But we do die, don't we? And if we haven't passed on our knowledge, it dies with us. So I talk to the elders."
Sherlock doesn't tell John that he simply must have some way to pass the time when they are not together, or that he's been systematically creating an ice palace in his mind to store the information he's gathering. Sometimes he fears that John, who is so much a part of the earth, will not understand him, who is so much a part of the stars. Sherlock has catalogued several of the elder stories at this point. Some of them are true, having happened recently enough to be verified, but some are likely to be tall tales, legends that could not possibly have happened. John asks,
"So, what else have you been chatting to the old birds about?"
"Flying."
"Flying? For real? With these?"
John flaps his wings as if he expects to take flight.
"Well, yes, but not the possibility of it, John. The history of it. I asked Vela about it, because according to the legend about Pono, we haven't flown since Apo's betrayal, when Korora took the unhatched egg back to the stars with her."
While Sherlock doesn't believe in the legend, he is fascinated by the possibility penguins might have once soared in the skies above.
"I wanted to know more about what we may have been like before then."
John settles down on his haunches and shuffles to make himself comfortable. Sherlock wants to sit right on top of him.
"So, what did she say?"
"She said that back then, ages and ages ago, we had longer, broader wings. When we were first grounded, many of us died because we couldn't fly away when winter came. And not just emperors. Vela and the other knowledge keepers think that there were types of penguins then that don't even exist now, because they couldn't adapt to the change."
John is staring at him, listening intently to every word, and Sherlock warms under the attention.
"What types of penguins?"
"Well, there are 6 kinds on the continent and surrounding islands now, right?"
"Right, yeah, 6.
Us, Macaroni, Adelie, Chinstrap, Rockhopper, and Gentoo."
"Correct. Based on fossils found on the continent, it seems probable that there were at least 4 other types of peng species that no longer exist. One of them was even bigger than us,
and we're the biggest penguins there are. Something catastrophic must have happened to completely wipe them out. Something like losing their primary means of locomotion, which is essential to fleeing danger and hunting and, well, everything. John's bill is hanging open. Sherlock reaches over and pushes it shut, but John opens it again to speak.
That's incredible! So how did the rest of us survive?
We learned to swim. John holds his wings out in front of him, moves them up and down and from side to side, as if he'd never seen them before. Then he budges closer to investigate Sherlock's wings, too. He stands behind him, rotating one of his wings in small circles, and Sherlock hears him murmur,
"That's why we call them wings still, instead of what they really are. Really, they're flappers."
John's belly is tickling Sherlock's back. Sherlock wants him to never move. John lets Sherlock's wings down and lifts up the other.
They move just like a skybird's wings, though. The same exact movements.
John moves around to face Sherlock again, and although Sherlock misses the warmth of him against his back, he is distracted by the sad look on John's face.
What's wrong? Do you ever feel bad that we can't fly anymore? I mean, can you imagine what that would be like, to move that fast and be that free?
Sherlock steps closer. He wants to comfort John, but doesn't know how. Besides, John is being silly.
John, think about it.
About what?
About us and our wings. We can still fly. We fly in the water. We move just as fast as a skybird, and dive and leap and spin, do everything they can do. The water is our sky, John.
John is grinning at him now and rocking back and forth on his webbed feet.
You're brilliant. You really are. You're fabulous.
You think I'm fabulous?
Yeah, and you know I do. What about me? You are the most fabulous creature under the skies, John Ling. But not brilliant? In your own way. Diplomacy must run in your family, you pengit.
John rubs the side of his neck against Sherlock's when he says it, so he can't really be angry.
John, all the brilliance in our world couldn't outshine you. Not ever.
The tip of John's tongue is peeking out again. Sherlock stares at it.
Thank you, Sherlock. You don't have to thank me, John. It's the truth.
No, not about me being fabulous, but thanks for that, too. No, I mean thanks for making me feel better about the flying thing. I hadn't thought of it that way before. It's kind of a relief to know that I'll never feel bad about not flying again. Sherlock feels his chest swelling and his heart squeezing and his belly fluttering. He did it. He gave John comfort, and he didn't even know he was doing it. Notes. The island which served as inspiration for the island in this story is essentially a large, boring, uninspired block of ice. It has nothing on it but pangs, which is why they make do without building nests or presenting relics to their mates. We've discussed it quite a lot and have agreed that artistic license is preferable to a doll island. Thus, our pangs have an assortment of objects which made it to their island from the mainland, by chance or magic, whichever you prefer. It is believed that penguins evolved from birds that could fly. Evidence shows that penguins were around 60 million years ago, and that this change from sky to water took a very, very long time. Why they would have stayed in environments that required this adaptation, however, is unknown.